that the Institute undertakes. We need money to run the Institute, and it comes from membership fees, but the membership fees are modest, they have not been increased recently, and we urge people to go beyond membership and make donations. So please bear this in mind. I might mention here, when I'm talking about the Institute, that the program next week will be given, the lecture will be given by the new president of Simon Fraser University, Dr. William Sewell, who will be speaking on China's race against time, modernization and education. I come now to our program this evening. Our speaker, as the program announced, is the Honorable Mr. Justice Brian Dixon of the Supreme Court of Canada. Mr. Justice Dixon has earned the reputation of being among the ablest of the judges who have sat on that court. And that really is a sufficient introduction of him. But some of us like to know a bit more about the person of our lecturer, and I will just mention one or two biographical details. He was born in Saskatchewan at Yorkton, had his school education in Saskatchewan, I believe it was in Regina, and then he went to Manitoba to the law school there. He graduated in 1938 with the gold medal in law. He was called to the bar in 1940 and then went off to war. He had a distinguished service record, came back to Canada and started practicing in Manitoba and remained in practice until 1963. During this period, he kept some contact with the university life. He lectured in law for some 6 years, I think it was, 1948 to 54. And then in 1963, he was appointed to the bench of Manitoba, the Court of Queen's Bench, and served there for 10 years. In 1973, he was appointed to the Supreme Court of Canada, where he still sits. I understand he is now the third senior judge on that court. Mr. Justice Dixon has a large number of honorary degrees. I think there are some 5 honorary LLDs. So perhaps we should be, in the university setting, calling him Dr. Dixon. We are grateful to him for leading off the program this year, and I will now invite him to speak to us on his chosen topic, the forgotten party, the victim of crime.
Thank you, Professor Byrne, for your generous introduction. It is for me an enormous pleasure to have the opportunity of addressing this prestigious Vancouver Institute, and an honor to be included among the distinguished speakers whom you have selected for the current season. The subject which I have chosen, as Professor Byrne has stated, is the forgotten person, the victim of crime. Now, it's commonplace to refer to victims of crime as the forgotten persons in the criminal justice system. There's more than a grain of truth to the commentary. The increase in protective rights accorded criminal offenders at every stage of the criminal justice system has not been matched by a corresponding societal response to the plight of the innocent victim. Now, at first glance, one might think there's inevitably a contest between the rights of the accused or convicted offenders on the one hand and the rights of the victims of crime on the other. It might seem that society must make a choice as to which of the two deserves protection. But in reality, there's no such sharp dichotomy. There's much can be done to respond to the plight of the victims without in any way impinging upon the rights of those alleged or proven to be criminals. Currently, increasing recognition is being given to the problems faced by victims who suffer first at the hands of the criminal and again at the hands of the criminal justice system. The release in July of this year of a report of a federal provincial task force on crime victims is but one indication that our policymakers are taking a serious look at the problem. The problem was also the theme of the annual meeting of the chiefs of police in Calgary in August. The term victimology has entered the lexicon. The United Nations meeting on prevention of crime, set for 1985, has placed the rights of victims of crime very high on the agenda. Interest groups lobbying for crime victims have been formed, and the Minister of Justice, the Honorable Mark McGuigan, has said that the victims' movement is indeed a justice revolution. Victims, qua victims, are finally being noticed. Now, how is it that the victim got lost in the shuffle? A glance at history tells that the victim was once the central figure in any proceeding against an offender. In the early days of the development of the English law, there was no distinction recognized between public wrongs and private wrongs. All were treated as private wrongs. It was the responsibility of the victim or his family to proceed against the offender, and it was the victim who stood to benefit from any court order against the offender. The state played no role in the process. Around the 12th century, however, the notion of crime as being something different from a civil wrong began to take shape. There emerged certain matters which came to be regarded as offenses against the king's peace. The category of offenses falling within the king's peace gradually expanded. It was in the name of the king that offenses against the king's peace were prosecuted, and it was on behalf of the king that fines were extracted or other forms of punishment imposed. The victim could pursue his own private remedy against an offender in a civil separate action, a claim in tort. Over time, proceedings in respect of a crime and a tort have become increasingly distinct. It has evolved that there are certain standards of proof between a criminal proceeding where the guilt must be proved beyond reasonable doubt and a civil proceeding in which liability need only be shown on a balance of probabilities. With a sharp distinction between crime and tort, the victim's role in the criminal process became increasingly a secondary one. The separation between crime and tort continues and remains central to our present court structure in Canada, as it is generally in the common law countries. This is in contrast to the position, for example, in France, where it is possible at the victim's option to join a civil to a criminal proceeding and have them conducted at the same time together in a criminal court. In Canada, there's also a constitutional reality. It's the responsibility of the federal government to determine what constitutes a crime, whereas it's the responsibility of the provincial legislatures to deal with civil wrongs. The underlying conceptual basis for the distinction between crime and tort is that a crime is a wrong against society as a whole. Although the grievance is inflicted on the individual victim, the state is seen as the injured party, and the penal process is instituted in the name of the state. The victim is not one of the dramatis personae. Criminal law is a definition of what society deems to be unacceptable behavior. Even if the offender and the victim have come to a reconciliation, there has still been harm done to the rest of society. I think it's important to maintain the notion that the criminal law contains a statement of society's norms. But having said that, it does not follow that the victim's irrelevant. A crime is something more than direct harm done to an individual, but the harm done to the victim is certainly part of the wrong done by the criminal. It's rather unfortunate that victimization is a rather common occurrence. No class, race, age is immune. If you will permit the introduction or intrusion of a personal note, I might say that I was a victim of crime earlier this year. A farmhouse we own was broken into and articles stolen. The detective work was excellent. The offenders were apprehended almost immediately, yet many months elapsed before the case was disposed of and the articles which had been stolen were returned. I speak therefore with some personal experience, however modest, about the unhappy plight of victims of crime. A Gallup poll in 1982 indicated that one in four Canadians had been a victim of crime in the preceding 12 months. The official statistics reveal that in 1982, there were about 2.2 million criminal code offenses reported. Of these, approximately 169,000, or 7.7%, were crimes of violence, murder, manslaughter, infanticide, sexual assaults, other assaults, robbery. The rate of violent crime for Canada was 685 per 100,000 population. The rate for British Columbia was considerably higher, 1,144 per 100,000 population. About two-thirds of reported criminal code offenses, almost 1.5 million, were crimes against property. Again, British Columbia had more than its fair share. The rate for the whole country was 5,962 per 100,000 population, whereas in our most westerly province, it was 8,532 per 100,000. The statistics of the incidents of crime reflect only those crimes reported to the authorities. What about unreported crimes? A victimization survey conducted 2 years ago indicated that the quantum of crime concealed from official statistics is massive. The study covered seven major urban centers: Vancouver, Edmonton, Winnipeg, Toronto, Montreal, Halifax, Dartmouth, and St. John's. The survey found that 58% of the crimes committed went unreported. The most common reasons were that the offense was too minor, or the belief that, and I quote, the police couldn't do anything about it anyway. Still, in almost a quarter of the cases, one reason was that it was too inconvenient, or the victim didn't want to take the time. In 43% of the sexual assault cases, the attitude of the police and the courts was given as the reason for non-reporting. Now, all in all, these results are hardly a vote of confidence by victims in the criminal justice system. Traditionally, the victim's role in the criminal justice system has been nothing more than of being just another witness. Yet the victim tends to identify the case as his or hers, yet there's currently no real recognition of such a claim in our criminal process. The time, I think, is long overdue for us to acknowledge formally and tangibly that the victim does have a special interest. That does not mean that he or she should be able to dictate how the case is to be handled, because the enforcement of the criminal law is or should be a matter of public policy. There's nothing, however, inconsistent in saying that the victim is in a special position compared to the average citizen. The recent federal provincial task force notes that one of the biggest problems faced by victims is a lack of basic information. That claim is verified by the experience of the victim assistance programs, such as those established in Calgary and Winnipeg. The victim is often confused about how the criminal justice system works and what his or her role is in it. He often doesn't know what's happening, how the investigation's proceeding, when the case is coming to court, whether there's been any plea bargaining, whether the accused is pleading guilty, or whether there'll be a trial, what the disposition of the case was, what sentence was imposed if the accused was found guilty. I only learned of the final disposition of my case some weeks after the culprits had pleaded guilty and were sentenced, and only as a result of telephone calls to the police. Now, such lack of information can be frustrating for a victim. It contributes to the feeling that the system has no concern for him. The current situation is generally that the victim is not provided with such information unless the victim takes the initiative to find out. The task force recommends that a systematic effort to provide victims with basic information as a routine and integral function of personnel within the criminal justice system, and I fully concur. The victim's role as witness is another area in which I think a little bit of attention can go a long way toward alleviating concerns. In an adversary system such as we have, the role of a victim is often not easy. Being subjected to cross-examination can be a trying experience. The task will be much less unpleasant, however, if the victim at least knows what to expect. Witness assistance programs, which provide centralized sources of information, have been established in a number of centers in Canada, and they appear successful. In Winnipeg, for example, brochures giving general information are distributed to witnesses, and requests for specific information are handled by a witness reception area. The witness assistance program also handles cancellation of court appearances. The program seems to produce more personalized, more efficient interaction with witnesses, cutting down on inconvenience resulting from unnecessary court appearances and bureaucratic runaround. The witness assistance program has links with other programs and social agencies, and so can operate as an effective referral service. Witnesses who are victims may have special concerns about their role. It's been suggested that there be separate waiting areas for victim witnesses so that the victim can avoid unpleasant or intimidating confrontation with the accused and his friends. A more controversial suggestion to ease the trauma of victims, especially when they are witnesses, is the recommendation of the Federal Provincial Task Force that the criminal code be amended to allow all victims to make an application for in-camera hearing and an order prohibiting publication or broadcast of their identity. The criminal code under the recommendation would be amended to require the judge to advise the victim of this right at the first opportunity. The presiding judge would then assess the circumstances of the particular case and the reasons of the victim before making the appropriate order. Now, this proposal has been criticized as a dangerous attack on two of the fundamental tenets of Canadian society, the principle of an open judicial system where justice can be seen to be done, and the freedom of the press to make that clear. Another aspect of the criminal justice system that can be very, very frustrating is delay. One study conducted in the mid-70s in Peel, just outside Toronto, endeavored to interview victims both before and after their cases went to court to see how their attitudes changed. Of a potential sample of 429, there were 55 cases, almost 13%, in which the second interview could not be conducted because the case had not yet been disposed of by the time the study ended 2.5 years later, after the study began. Delay leaves the impression with the victim that there's very little concern for his case. Now, the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms provides in Section 11 that any person charged with an offense has the right to be tried within a reasonable time. As it is written, it is clearly designed to be the right of an accused person, but speedy justice can equally be seen as the right of the victim. And this is one instance in which the interests of victim and accused can actually coincide. Now, overcoming at least some problems of delay is clearly feasible. In British Columbia, there have recently been adopted a number of case management procedures to try and streamline the handling of criminal cases from the first involvement of the police through to the end of trial. The procedures are not complex. They simply reflect the fact that attention is being paid to the most effective way of doing things. Increased coordination among all the relevant actors is the key. An evaluation concludes that the result is savings both in time and in cost, and everyone benefits, including the victim. Now, one stage of a criminal trial process in which victims show a particular interest is sentencing. Also, for most criminals, sentencing is the most significant aspect of the criminal trial process because a great majority of offenders plead guilty. The latitude of what may be considered by a trial judge in determining what is the appropriate sentence is very broad. The circumstances of the particular offense committed are certainly major factors. I think we are belatedly beginning to realize that the specific crime cannot be put into proper context without an appreciation of the impact of the crime upon the victim. At the present time, especially in cases involving plea bargaining, the judge most often passes sentence without learning about the crime's impact. A case can be settled and the offender's sentenced without anyone ever contacting the victim. The task force recommends that the criminal code be amended to provide for what they call victim impact statements to be considered at the time of sentencing. The practical method suggested is that a statement be part of a pre-sentence report. A requirement for victim impact statements was recently enacted in legislation at the federal level in the United States. In the same vein, a case arose in British Columbia just over a year ago, in which accused pleaded guilty to 2 counts of having sexual intercourse with a female under the age of 14. At sentencing, counsel for the victim sought to make submissions about the emotional effect of the offenses. Both Crown and defense counsel opposed the move. The provincial court judge's refusal to hear the submission was challenged in the British Columbia Supreme Court. That court concluded the victim had no standing to make representations before the court unless called by the Crown. Now, I must confess that my initial reaction upon reading the case was, why not? And on reflection, it still strikes me as inconsistent with the general discretion of the trial judge at sentencing to hear whatever he thinks relevant from whatever source. Although with the right of the accused to demand formal proof of any assertion which the accused wishes to challenge. A very experienced judge of the Supreme Court of Ontario, with whom I discussed this matter recently, wrote to me as follows, and he said, for some years I have requested the victims to attend at the time of representation on sentence so that I, the sentencing judge, will have some idea from the aggrieved persons of the effect upon them of the actions of the accused, what were the immediate and what were the long-term effects. Now, the victim has no standing to compel prosecution by the Crown of the crime against him or to contest decisions to dismiss or reduce the charges or to accept plea bargains. He lacks a judicially cognizable interest in the prosecution or non-prosecution of the alleged malefactor. Nevertheless, he should have the right to know that the judge took his or her plight into account in considering appropriate sentence. Sentencing is also the one place in which the victim can receive a tangible benefit from the criminal trial process, that's to say by what we call a restitution order. Restitution was once the basic element of any court order against an offender. As I've mentioned, in the days before a distinction was drawn between crime and tort, it was to the victim that any penalty flowed. With the development of a separate trial process, the state usurped the position of the victim, taking over not only responsibility for prosecutions, but also the monetary benefit of any fines. More recently, restitution has started to make something of a comeback, and it's now being viewed in a much broader context. In current terms, restitution can be seen as benefiting not only the victim, but also the offender and society generally. In 1974, the Law Reform Commission of Canada recommended that restitution be considered one of the basic guidelines governing the sentencing process. In a working paper entitled Restitution and Compensation, the Commission offered the following observations, and I quote, recognition of the victim's needs underlines at the same time the larger social interest inherent in the individual victim's loss. Thus, social values are reaffirmed through restitution to victim. Society gains in other ways as well. To the extent that restitution works toward self-correction and prevents or at least discourages the offender's committal to a life of crime, the community enjoys a measure of protection, security, and savings. Depriving offenders of the fruits of their crimes or ensuring that offenders assist in compensating victims for their losses should assist in discouraging criminal activity. Finally, the Commission said, to the extent that restitution encourages society to perceive crime in a more realistic way as a form of social interaction, it should lead to more productive responses, not only by Parliament, the courts, police, and correctional officials, but also by ordinary citizens and potential victims. The Commission's analysis was speculative. The actual effect of restitution orders upon offenders has not been the subject of much research and is little known. It may seem even incongruous to enforce civil claims through the mechanism of criminal sentencing, yet restitution sanctions are now firmly woven into the fabric of the Canadian penal system, and certainly the beneficial effects for the victim are obvious. Restitution can take the form of money payments, services, or both. It may be of interest that according to Ontario Ministry of Corrections statistics, 9,865 people completed community service orders from April 1982 to the end of January of this year. In 1981-82, 8,911 people were in the program, compared to only 2,184 the year before. Nearly $1,400,000 has been paid back to victims through the province's 52 restitution programs. Restitution orders will not always be appropriate. They're not a magic solution to the dilemma posed by sentencing, but they do merit serious consideration and assessment by the courts. The task force recommends that judges passing sentence be required to consider the appropriateness of a restitution order. In 1974, the Law Reform Commission could safely say restitution was little used in sentencing, although there were particular sections of the criminal code which did contemplate the option. Now, we still do not have adequate statistics which would indicate how frequently restitution orders are used or even the potential for their use. The most common method appears to be to include restitution orders as part of probation. One suspects that the potential for restitution is unexploited, but the lack of information up to the present makes it impossible to speak with any certainty. Restitution need not only arise at the formal sentencing stage. There are pilot projects in which restitution is the central theme of a diversion scheme. That is to say, a program in which the offender is never brought to court. Restitution is negotiated by mediation between the victim and the offender. Even when the case does go to court, restitution may well precede sentencing. For the offender, actual restitution may be the very best means of convincing the sentencing judge that he, the offender, has recognized the error of his ways and is prepared to accept responsibility for his actions. Restitution is thus another instance in which the interests of the victim and the offender can converge. The victim wants to recover his losses. The offender wants an alternative to prison. The common interest may only be a coincidence, yet it's a happy coincidence. Restitution associated with the criminal process is one means by which the victim may recoup all or part of the direct financial cost suffered as a consequence of crime. It's no means, however, by no means, the total solution. An order for restitution may not fit the circumstances of the case. A jail term often makes restitution impractical or impossible. Furthermore, in order for restitution to be viable, the offender must be in a position to pay. That is sometimes a serious problem. But perhaps the biggest flaw in the restitution remedy is that the whole thing is dependent upon the offender being caught. Theoretically, the victim also has a civil remedy against a criminal. But that has the same problems as restitution, as well as a couple of additional ones. The amount of damages that could be obtained, assuming a known offender with sufficient financial resources, may simply be not worth the time, effort, money, which a civil suit would entail. Civil remedies against criminals are, in fact, very little used. In part, this may be due to lack of awareness of the option. In a survey conducted about 10 years ago of victims of violent crime downtown Vancouver and in Delta, only 4% of the Vancouver residents succeeded in recovering anything from their attackers, while none of the Delta residents did. And similar results were obtained in an earlier Ontario study conducted by Osgoode Hall Law School. The straight financial loss suffered by victims of crime is in aggregate very considerable. The 1981 victimization study of 7 major urban centers gives a hint of the problem. The task force report summarized the result as follows. The gross financial loss to victims in the 7 cities surveyed are rather imposing for a single year. $211,500,000 in unrecovered property and cash. $42,900,000 in damage to property. An additional $7 million in associated medical expenses and lost wages. The victims reported that an additional $170 million was paid out to them through private insurance. Taken together, then, these figures give a total real cost of crime in excess of $431 million in 7 cities in a single year. Although the offender is one obvious source to which the victim can look in seeking to recoup direct financial loss, many victims would go unsatisfied if this were the only source available. Legislatures have partially responded to the gap by enacting compensation schemes in which the victim turns to the state for redress. This can be a significant remedy for victims, but its existence is not widely known. I would hazard the guess that it's possible to complete law school without ever having heard about crime victims' compensation legislation. And therefore, I think a member of the general public is even less likely to know. The idea of victim compensation, of course, is hardly novel. About 4,000 years ago, Hammurabi's Babylonian code contained this provision. If the robber is not caught, the man who has been robbed shall formally declare whatever he has lost before a god, and the city and the mayor in whose territory or district the robbery has been committed shall replace whatever he's lost for him. If it is the life of the owner that is lost, the city or the mayor shall pay 1 munch of silver to his kinfolk. In modern times, The legislative response to the question of compensation for victims of crime has been remarkably similar in different jurisdictions. The pioneer was New Zealand, which in 1963 passed an act to provide compensation paid by the state for victims of violent crime. Other jurisdictions, shortly thereafter, followed the New Zealand lead. The United Kingdom introduced its scheme in 1964. 1965, California became the first American state to adopt such a plan. Now, more than half of the states have done likewise. The first Canadian province to take the plunge was Saskatchewan in 1967. The idea caught on quickly in Canada. When British Columbia adopted its scheme in 1972, it was the eighth province to do so. Since then, the two territories and one more province, Nova Scotia, have followed suit. All these programs are cost shared by the federal government. Currently, Prince Edward Island is the only holdout. That province does not have a scheme for the compensation of victims of violent crime. Now, the literature is hard-pressed to find a convincing rationale to explain why crime victims should be treated differently from other persons suffering injuries from, for example, a natural disaster. It's sometimes suggested that the state has failed in its duty to prevent crime. However, it's unrealistic to think that the state could ever hope to protect all people at all times. The rationale places the duty simply too high. Alternatively, it's been suggested that crime injuries compensation can be supported on a welfare philosophy, helping those in financial need. The difficulty with this argument is that most schemes do not impose a means or needs test. The only Canadian program in which financial need is taken into account for final awards is Saskatchewan. Also, how is a given injury more of a financial hardship because it's the result of a crime? A third suggestion has been an insurance rationale, that criminal injuries compensation represents an assumption of shared risk against crime. But again, why insurance only against crime? The attention to criminal injuries compensation seems to reflect more pragmatic than theoretical considerations. With scarce resources, victims of crime are selected for priority treatment. I think this is in part designed to balance the criminal justice system. If we're concerned about the rights of an accused or convicted criminal, we must have some regard for the needs of the victim. I think it may also reflect a greater sympathy for an injured person when someone else intentionally caused the injury. Probably also recognized that a victim of crime rarely has an effective remedy against the offender, either because he's unapprehended or, if apprehended, penniless, or rendered judgment-proof by the penal process. Whatever the rationale, there is a widespread assumption amongst legislators that victims of crime do deserve special treatment. The assumption is, however, only carried so far. You will have noticed that the compensation schemes are for victims of violent crime. The focus is on personal injury damages. Every jurisdiction has chosen not to include property crimes. The choice seems to reflect a pragmatic cost consideration rather than any clear principle. Property crimes are much more numerous than crimes of violence, and in the aggregate, of course, represent much more extensive financial loss. The restriction of state-funded compensation to victims of violent crime reflects the fact that our society treats personal injury more seriously than property loss. And it's also fair to say that the property losses are more likely to be covered by private insurance. The prevailing method of identifying violent crimes covered by the schemes is through a scheduled list of criminal code offenses. All the crimes one would ordinarily associate with violence are included, with one significant exception. Most schemes in Canada and elsewhere, and British Columbia is included, find very convincing. Intention, sometimes labeled mens rea, is a basic requirement of criminal liability, and if there's sufficient intention to ground criminal liability for the offender, it should be enough to extend to the victim. There's, however, a more convincing rationale, I think, for the exclusion of driving offenses, and that is that the victim can look elsewhere for his recovery, either to private insurance or unsatisfied judgment funds. Criminal injuries compensation is designed to be the last insurer. Other sources of compensation reduce the awards. Another limitation on the extent of recovery is that most jurisdictions, including British Columbia, impose minimum claim levels, frequently $100. Maximum award levels are also imposed. In British Columbia, the amount to be paid for the injury or death of a victim shall not exceed, for lump sum payments, $25,000. Now, amounts such as this are more than a symbolic palliative, but they're far from munificent, having regard to the inflationary trends of recent years. Monetary restrictions are clearly meant to preserve the public treasury, but they can be harsh for the individual victim. All schemes include the conduct of the victim as a factor in determining whether compensation should be awarded or what amount should be given. The emphasis is on the innocent victim. All programs also include Good Samaritan provisions. Coverage is extended to persons assisting in the arrest of a criminal or in the prevention of a crime. Indeed, coverage for Good Samaritans is broader than for ordinary victims in that their injuries need not arise from specified offenses. Also, in most jurisdictions in Canada, not including British Columbia, Good Samaritans are eligible for higher awards. Criminal injury compensation schemes do not require identification or conviction of an offender for the victim to recover. In that sense, statutory compensation is far superior to tort remedies or restitution orders. Where the offender is known, however, the compensation may be less than could be obtained by suing the offender. The victim retains this option, even though it's little used. Victims cannot recover twice. Once compensation is paid, the board has a subrogated right against the offender to the extent of the compensation paid. In theory, this gives the compensation scheme a means of recouping costs, but in practice, it's not a significant revenue source. British Columbia's recovery in the past has ranged from 5% of payouts 1 year to 0.2 in another year, and such low recovery rates seem to be typical. Now, I've said quite a bit about the financial cost of victimization. It's becoming, however, very apparent that emotional costs are also extremely high. Researchers are only beginning to collect information on such emotional consequences. I think we'd all expect the victim of violent crime to suffer emotionally. Let me quote from an actual case, the examination in chief recently of a rape victim in Ontario. I have now 3 locks on my door in case someone tries to break into my apartment. If I come home at night, I put the first lock, and I have 5 closets, and I check each one. I check those, then I put the other 2 locks on the door. I have a pair of scissors beside my bed. If someone breaks into my apartment, I have something to defend myself with. If I go out to visit a friend or something, I don't take a bus. I take a cab. When I come home, I phone her, or she phones me to see if I'm all right. I don't go out at night anymore, anywhere. If I have any shopping to do, it's done during the daytime. I always take a cab if I go out. If I see a bunch of young guys, I think they belong to a street gang and wonder if they raped some girls. I don't trust people, mostly males. I'm more tense and jumpy now. I have a very hard time relaxing. I'm seeing a psychiatrist right now, and I go for psychiatric classes. I took 2 jobs to keep myself busy so I could sleep at nights, so that I would be completely exhausted. A Quebec task force on armed robbery found that almost without exception, the victims felt an unspeakable terror when attacked. Some never overcame it. It's obvious that fear for one's life or limb can produce serious emotional upset. But what is perhaps less obvious is that victims whose physical well-being is never threatened also often experience serious emotional reaction. The Winnipeg Victim Assistance Program, to which I referred a moment ago, pays particular attention to break and entry cases and with purse snatching cases. It was found that emotional support was one of the frequent needs of such victims. A senior member of the Winnipeg Police Department made the following comment. It's an extreme trauma they go through. You can slap a person's face or you can kick them in the seat of the pants and it only hurts for a minute. But if you invade their privacy, their home, which is their castle, then you really shake them up. They feel like they've been violated, whether they've been physically touched or not. Similar reactions were reported in a survey of burglary victims in the United Kingdom. 5 people among a sample of 322 were prompted to burn clothing or furniture touched by the burglar. This is rather perhaps an extreme reaction, but even the more typical response shows that burglary can be traumatic. Even several weeks after the burglary, most victims in the study felt unease, insecurity. In the 1981 victimization survey of the 7 urban centers in Canada, a quarter of those polled said there should be emotional or psychological counseling available to victims of their type of crime. This included many victims of property crimes, and official and other offenses generally categorized among the less serious. The emotional needs of these people are clearly important. Now, I have referred to some of the informational, financial, emotional needs of victims. The more we look, the more we seem to discover the victim has needs. The assistant programs in both New Westminster and Winnipeg each encountered this phenomenon. When victims were simply invited to contact the program if they had problems, utilization was modest. When the program made direct personal contact with victims, many did have needs to which the program could and did respond. Now, my purpose this evening has not been to exhaust all of the issues raised in respect of victims of crime, but rather to put some of the issues fairly before you. Time does not permit me to discuss the particular nature of many of the needs of victims, nor to review the requirements of special categories of crime. The paradigms, I think, of undeserved suffering are the sexual assault victims, the battered wives, abused children, traffic injury victims, and the elderly. I have also not said anything about the victims of white-collar crime. In fact, there's very little research and very little known about the effects in Canada of white-collar crime. But even a general overview of the needs of victims of traditional types of crime reveals a serious problem in our society. An appropriate response to the needs of victims can in some way be accomplished simply by changes in attitude or redeployment of existing resources. But many of the services required cost money. In particular, the compensation schemes, the rape crisis centers, the transition homes for battered wives require considerable investment of funds. In difficult economic times, victims have to compete for scarce financial resources. The task force recommends that consideration be given to imposing some kind of fine surtax upon persons convicted of criminal offenses. The surtax would be an additional penalty to any other sanction earmarked for the funding of services to victims, and it could be either a flat or variable rate. A number of American jurisdictions have adopted such a scheme. At first glance, it may seem an obvious response. There's certain poetic justice in making the victim pay, or to make the criminal pay for the victim. But I think we should look very carefully before we leap. One must ask why victims, or why the criminals as a class, should all be painted with the same brush. For example, if fine surtax were designed to fund the current compensation schemes, one would have a situation in which criminals at large were forced to underwrite the consequences of crimes committed by a much smaller group of criminals, the perpetrators of violent crime. Is a shoplifter really any more responsible for a brutal assault than someone who has never been convicted of a criminal offense? Is one criminal more responsible for another criminal's deeds than is the ordinary taxpayer? The more broadly based the victim services that are provided, the stronger, of course, the rationale for an across-the-board levy on all criminals, even if of varying amounts. Nevertheless, the issue is much more complex than it may appear at first impression. The task force appears to acknowledge this, since it made no specific recommendation, merely suggested it be explored. I have been describing ways in which criminal justice, I think, can be improved from the standpoint of the victim and increased services made available. Victims deserve attention. Criminal justice system can and should be responsive to victim and witness needs, both as a matter of simple justice and in recognition of the fact that cooperation of victims is essential to the apprehension and conviction of criminals. A spirit of cooperation will not be engendered if law-abiding citizens feel left out of the process. There's much about the needs of victims that we do not yet fully understand or appreciate, but we can at least begin to undo the damage caused by past neglect and indifference. We cannot repair the criminal wrongs inflicted upon the victims, but we can see that crime victims and witnesses are not further victimized by the criminal justice system. Thank you.
We shall have questions, as our custom. Before I do that, I have to establish a fact. Was there an overflow audience in the other room? Because if there was, we'll have to make a visit there. So would someone find out for me whether we did in fact overflow? The television camera has been rolling for the purpose of providing an overflow audience with the picture, but I'm not sure that we did need it because there are seats still here. Well, until that fact is established, we'll proceed with questions. Now, may I say first that you have to speak up. You have difficulty hearing me without a microphone, and we will have equal difficulty hearing you. And we'd like to answer the questions that are asked and not imagine a question and then answer it. So let's have the first one, I think.
Mr. Klein.
Can I ask you to launch this question?
Yes, Mr. Klein.
What is his opinion in regard to severity of penalty as a deterrent to crime, as, for instance, capital punishment as a deterrent to murder?
Yes. Do I consider severity a deterrent, and particularly with particular attention to the capital punishment as a possible deterrent from those who would otherwise commit murder? I think I would answer that by saying, first of all, that it's very difficult to know what crimes would have been committed if they haven't been committed, and therefore in the sense that we do not know how many murders, more murders or fewer murders, would have been committed if we had continued to have the capital punishment. As a trial judge, I don't recall one case in which I sat on a murder case in which the presence of capital punishment would have affected the outcome. We all have our own personal views on capital punishment. I personally am against it. I do not think that it is any particular deterrent. I think it's a very dehumanizing procedure for those who are called upon on behalf of the state to impose it. You will recall, Mr. Klein, very well, I'm sure, a period for a number of years in which we went through what was virtually a charade when it was still on the books. I sat on several capital murder cases, and we all knew at that time that even if the verdict brought in by the jury was guilty, that the punishment would be commuted. So for a number of years, it invariably there was commutation. I've heard a very substantial number of cases, and those who were part of the system knew that that would be done. And I personally felt it was a very positive thing when there was a free vote within Parliament on the matter of capital punishment. It was sufficiently positive so that the issue has not really been raised in any meaningful sense since that time. So that's a rather lengthy answer to your question, but if it, there's so much, I think you as a former trial judge and I would appreciate, I think the most difficult thing that a judge has to do as a trial judge is sentencing. It's just it's a very anguishing obligation to impose a sentence on a fellow human. And it's such a, the information we have is so minuscule normally that the responsibility is great, and the information is small. And when you get into the question of the degree of severity operating as a deterrent, I think we could discuss that probably for a very long time, but I'm not entirely convinced that more severe sentences are likely to reduce the incidence of crime. Yes?
Your Lordship, remind the facts of the couriers of automobiles, all the way through to drunken drivers, are responsible for many victims in our society. To what extent has your court given special attention to dealing with the victims of crimes as far as the automobile is concerned?
To what extent has our court dealt with the victims of crime insofar as the automobile case is being concerned? Our jurisdiction is found in Section 41 of the Supreme Court Act. It says that the court has jurisdiction to consider any issue of law or mixed law and fact which is of general importance to Canada. And therefore, the issues which we get are national issues of major importance. The question of victims of crime have both, or of automobile accidents, those who have been struck and injured, come to us, of course, in a civil case occasionally, but rarely does an automobile accident reach us. It used to 10 years before 1975, because up till then, if $10,000 was at issue, a person had the right to go to our court. But since that $10,000 rule has been abrogated, it's no longer the case, and so the number of times that an automobile accident victim comes to us, I think you could probably count on the fingers of one hand. So it has not been an issue up to the present time. Yes?
Is there any data available to compare the rate of recidivism or the deterrence as between the where restitution is requested as where it's just simple sentencing and jail?
I haven't seen figures to that effect. No, I don't. I'm not aware if there are any. Yes?
Society is dull or mad. Has any consideration been given to seizing property of the criminal if he's been involved in a violent crime and there is a victim? The state to seize that property and then use it for the compensation fund.
That has been suggested. The question which was asked by Mrs. Nemetz was whether there is a mechanism by which the judge could say to the accused person at the time of sentencing, you have a certain amount of property, we're going to seize that property, we will sell it and use the proceeds to assist in alleviating the injury to the victims. Up to the present time, that has not been implemented. There is a minor section in the criminal code where if there's minor damage to property, the judge can order that. But the idea of the judge, in effect, seizing the victim's property and taking it under some sort of an order and then selling it is not, at the present time, part of our law. It
might
be. It has been mooted, and I understand there are arguments that one can put up both ways. Normally, up to the present time, as I sought to indicate in my paper, the state has left it to the victim to commence civil proceedings if the offender can be identified and if he's found to have property, and the money goes then if the victim is successful in the civil proceeding, it goes to the victim directly rather than through the state. Dr. Burn, do you want to indicate who you would like to? All right. Correct.
Is it possible that judges at the time of sentencing can insist on restitution in physical terms. I'm thinking, for example, of a graffiti artist who ruins the front of a building. Yeah. Has the average trial judge the right to insist that that man stands there and repaints the building or hammers away at the concrete to remove the scars that are on it?
Well, increasingly, community service orders are being used. The procedure which you suggest to say to the person, you must do this or do that, can be part of a probation order, and the judge at the time of sentencing can say, well, I will put you on probation, but you must do this, 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 and this, and if you fail to do so, then you will come back and be sentenced. And so that sort of order has on occasion been used, but not to any great extent.
Well, people can do a lot of good.
Yeah, well, I think it might well. I think it might well.
The other point which ties in with this is, has the pillory been completely outlawed?
The question was whether or not the pillory has been completely outlawed, and I find that rather easy to answer, and the answer is yes.
I was very happy to hear that you were victimized.
I was a victim,
And I wish that more of the jurists
are victimized. You wish that more of the jurists?
And legislators, if they are victimized, some action will take place where remedies will be forthcoming much faster.
Well, you...
The second question that I have to ask you is what Dr. Klein was just saying, or similar to that. Will you please comment about the justice or injustice of the Muslim criminal law? I think if you understand. One more question. The next question is, the community is very indifferent towards the crime. You see in the paper that hundreds of people looking at a person committing the crime, and nobody comes forward to defend the victim. And I believe that the community or the block in which a crime is committed, each householder should pay $10 for the crime, and then they will pay more respect to that and will do something. How can you introduce that?
Thank you, sir. There are three questions asked. The first suggestion was to the effect that if more judges were victimized or more of our parliamentarians were victimized, we'd have quicker action in the legislation, which would have... And that may be quite true, because it tends to concentrate the mind immensely when one has been a victim in however small a way. I do think, though, as I indicated, that this whole subject, Mark McGuigan is very interested in it. I've discussed it with him. So I don't think you will find that it's going to be put on the back burner. I think it's one of the subjects which Parliament is very interested in. The second question had to do with the Mohammedan criminal code, if that's a church law, of course. And some of their penalties involve cutting off hands and heads and stoning to death. I find that a little bit overdoing it. I don't think it would meet with any great support if it were put to a referendum in Canada. Apart from that, I'm not any authority on Mohammedan law, and I hesitate to express any further view. The third question was...
The community.
Now, that's a good question, and I'll tell you why. Because in one of the states of United States, Minnesota, they have within the last couple of weeks introduced a piece of legislation which makes it a crime for me or you to fail to go to the aid of somebody who is being attacked. The other aspect of it is that the victim can sue you or me, if we fail to assist them, for an unlimited amount. Now, on the first head of it, the fine is a fairly modest amount, but if you get into questions of serious physical injury, a personal award could amount to a very, very substantial amount. Now, it's a fairly contentious issue. The reason it was brought in was that you may recall several very ugly instances in the United States within the last several months, one of which a young girl was raped on a billiard table and 40 people stood around and laughed. None of them helped. And we all read about cases where people are slashed or wounded or otherwise injured when the passerbys pay no attention. So I think it is an interesting piece of legislation. I think it serves to underline the point that you were making, that there should be something that makes you and me accept some responsibility for if we fail to come to the aid of somebody who's really in trouble. Yes, sir?
Your Lordship, I was wondering if there have been any studies made through the welfare agencies in Canada to give the government of Canada some kind of an idea as to how much money annually is paid out by way of mother's allowance or any other welfare agencies or through direct contributions or gifts by relatives, neighbors, landlords, merchants, and others to help raise the orphans, that is, the people who are left, or support the widows of mm-hmm. those who have been killed either by in connection with cases where it would be a criminal case in connection with automobiles, killed by trains, mm-hmm. or in connection with robberies, or in connection with various other kinds of criminal activity. I personally know of 8 families who have been put into that category. Several of them were not in that category for long because other relatives, neighbors, friends, merchants, and the like saw that the children got education, saw mm-hmm. that they got support that they normally would have gotten had the parents survived. Mm-hmm. And I think that this is rather an important part of what should be a rather comprehensive study. I might further make this comment that some of us who have taken the trouble to do some research on the subject, in my particular case, I promoted the family court system of British Columbia, and I went into various aspects of law, and one of the points was probation, and then the old section 1081 of the Criminal Code had been passed in 1896, and it really was appalling in the minds of many interested people in churches, in welfare, and even in the law, that this section had been only used in a relative minimal way, whereas the background in some foreign jurisdictions, for example, in the year 1200, as you mentioned, Genghis Khan and Marco Polo put this kind of a system into effect that it was general, and the restitution for centuries had to be ninefold.
Thank you. The question, which was the whether the question, which, as I understand it, was whether the social agencies had made it sufficiently clear to our legislators that there's a large amount of money being used to aid the widows and the children of victims of violent crime, and whether or not the social agencies had made that all known. I would be very much surprised if there are any statistics on that particular aspect. And whether or not the social agencies have or have not made it known, I'm not in a position to say. I do know, as I mentioned earlier, that if, say, the husband in the family is murdered, there is a fund of $25,000 to look after the widow and the children, which is obviously very much very inadequate in a normal case. And therefore, the family of the victim of a murder are going to have to look to relatives or social agencies or to the state for support. The whole area is really being tilled for the first, or in very modest way up at the present time, but I think improvements are being made and will be made. Yes?
You mentioned plea bargaining.
Yes.
What is plea bargaining?
Plea bargaining is a...
Do we have it in this process?
Yes. You haven't. I think the criminal justice system would probably fall apart if there were not such a thing as plea bargaining. It's a mechanism whereby counsel for the accused can get together with counsel for the Crown and agree that if the accused pleads guilty to a lesser offense, take for example a murder case. The accused is charged with first or second degree murder. There's been evidence of a great amount of drinking. The lawyer for the accused may go to the Crown Counsel and say, my man will plead guilty to manslaughter, if the Crown will accept that plea, and that if the Crown agrees to that, and then the man is charged, the Crown changes its charge to one of manslaughter, the accused pleads guilty. That is plea bargaining. There are those who are against this. There are those who feel that it is a legitimate and proper mechanism, but it's in a sense just a bargain between the accused or his lawyer and the lawyer for the Crown, whereby they strike a bargain as a result of some form of immunity or lesser charge, the accused will plead guilty. Does that answer? All right. Do you want it? Professor Byrne feels that the witching hour has come. I'm very, very pleased to have the opportunity of speaking to you. And thank you very much.
I'm going to call on Chief Justice Nemetz to express our thanks to our speaker.
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, always a great pleasure to welcome my old friend and colleague, Sir Justice Dixon, to Vancouver. But on this occasion, it's also a pleasure my wife and myself to have, and for us to have here tonight as well, his wife, Mrs. Dixon. I welcome her as well on your behalf. Mr. Justice Dixon has been here since Wednesday, and I'm not sure that there hasn't been every moment of that time from then to tonight spent in addressing either this audience, audiences at the University of Students and Lawyers, the continuing law education only last night, and we are very grateful to him taking this time off from his busy calendar, because when he goes back on Monday, he'll go right back to sitting, to come to British Columbia, an unusual event and a happy one in the interest of all of us. Those of us who are in the law know him very well. I'm only sorry that his judgments are not widely read by the public, because we have always expect and do expect the eloquence and the lucidity and the elegant style of what he says on behalf of the public. His dedication is noted, very noted, throughout this Canada, and I, on your behalf, thank him for coming here and delivering this incisive and important address.